The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, a recently discovered fossilized sea sponge sheds new light on the evolutionary history of one of Earth's earliest multi-celled animals. And we'll learn how researchers used pirate's gold to dispel a centuries-old rumor. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Okay, so think back to your high school biology class. You might remember learning about the history of life on Earth. And you might also remember that sea sponges are some of the oldest multicellular animals on the planet. Scientists estimate they first appeared around 700 million years ago. The fossil record is somewhat incomplete. Scientists have estimated some fossilized sponges to have lived 540 million years ago, but that leaves a 160 million year gap. A recent discovery moves the needle back just slightly. Our first guest on today's program is Shuhai Shao, a geobiologist at Virginia Tech. His team's research, published in the journal Nature, shows how an unusual sponge fossil found in China offers a new glimpse into the evolutionary history of a simple, if not unassuming, animal.
When sea sponges evolved, it's an important question, but we still don't know. And the reason being that when sea sponges die, their body disintegrated very quickly. And although many of them make skeletons or hard parts, their hot pods would disintegrate and become dispersed in the sediment and sometimes become difficult to recognize. And we recently found that the earliest sea sponge may have not made any hot pods, so making it even more difficult to leave a fossil record.
Yeah, so we believe then that sea sponges have been around 700 million years or longer on Earth, but how far does the fossil record for, up until recently, how far back did the fossil record for sea sponges actually go?
Yeah, up until recently, the most convincing, indisputable sea sponge fossil record goes back to about 540 million years ago. So we're talking about perhaps a gap of 160 million years in the fossil record.
Now, I understand that you had a colleague that sent you pictures of a specimen and you took a look, and this sort of totally turned your understanding of fossilized sea sponges upside down. So can you tell me a little bit about this?
Yeah, exactly. So this fossil was discovered some years ago in China, and I've been collaborating with my colleagues in China. And they discovered a specimen that was about, according to our understanding, is about 550 million years old. So it's about 10 million years older than the previous known oldest sponge fossils. When I saw the picture, I was so amazed that it looked just like sea sponge. The architecture of the body, just like a modern glass sponge, but it didn't have glass. The fossil seems to be made of entirely of organic carbon, but the architecture of the fossil looked pretty much like modern glass sponge. So I immediately thought that this could be some of the earlier sponge without skeletons, without glass. It's basically a glass sponge without glass.
What does a glass sponge look like? I've never heard of a glass sponge before.
Glass sponge is a group of sponges that they make silica spicules or silica needles, and using those silica needles to build a skeleton, build a body, basically. They were thought to be some of the earliest sponges. And in the past, scientists believed that all the last common ancestor of all sponges had bimineralized skeletons. So sea sponge have three different groups or four, depending on how you classify them. And a glass sponge is one of them. And the common sponge, many of them also make silica skeletons. And a third major class, sometimes called calcareous sponge, instead of making silica skeletons, they make calcareous or calcium carbonate skeletons. So yes, glass sponge is so named because they use silica to make their skeletons, and the silica is the same material that we use to make glass.
This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Shuhai Shao, a geobiologist at Virginia Tech, about his team's research into a peculiar fossilized sponge that offers a new glimpse into the evolutionary history of one of Earth's oldest multicellular animals. So then this photo of this fossilized sponge that you estimated to be 550 million years old, it looks like one of these sponges that produces a skeleton using silica, but there's no evidence that there was actually silica used to help create the structure of this animal. Is that correct?
Exactly. But, you know, it turns out that when modern glass sponge started to make their silica skeletons in their lifetime, you know, when they just began to make the silica skeleton, the first thing they make is not, you know, precipitate silica. The first thing they make is make a little organic filament and line up this organic filament and then deposit the silica around the organic filament. So the sponge fossil that we found looked just like this organic filaments lined up to make rows and columns, but without the second step of depositing the silica around the organic filament.
This discovery sort of seems like it opens a lid on evolution, and you're now able to look even further back in the timeline of life to see how, well, in this instance, how sponges evolved. But to me, it just seems like there's just so much more to discover now that we know what to look for. In this case, sponges that don't have a silica skeleton.
Yes, I think, you know, We now know what to look for. It is the most important significance of this study, because in the past, paleontologists oftentimes think, you know, we have to find the silica or the calcareous skeleton to be able to call something a sponge. But now this new fossil tells us that, you know, maybe the earliest sponge animals use the organic matter to make their skeleton, but they have the architecture of modern sponge, but they didn't have the capability, or they didn't evolve the capability to deposit silica or other minerals around the organic scaffold or the organic templates. So it opens a new search image for the earliest sponge fossils.
What do you think that this sponge was up to 550 million years ago? Do you think its job in the ecosystem was similar to modern day sponges today?
Yeah, that's our inference. You know, their body plan or their architecture is almost identical to living sponges. So they're pretty big. They're about 40 centimeters in size. They're probably standing on the sea floor. They have holes on the body, and the water flows through these holes, and the sponge simply collect food particles or bacteria or organic particles from the water current in and out of the sponge body. So they're constantly just filtering water out of this ocean and collect this very small amount of organic carbon or food particle from the water currents.
At the time, were these simple sponges one of the dominant multicellular organisms on Earth? So, if you were to actually travel back in time 550 million years ago, imagine you'd see a lot of water. But what would you actually see in the sea? Would it be mostly sponges?
Sponge probably played a very important role in the ecosystem back in 550 many years ago. The other animals, including mobile animal or motile animal with a bilateral symmetry, most of the animals that we saw today have bilateral symmetry, are less common. So sponge probably played a disproportionately more important role compared to in the modern marine ecosystem.
And where will your research take you next? I know this probably leads to a lot of questions about history of life on Earth. And are you continuing to dig into the fossil record and seeing how far back we can push things?
Yes, certainly. We pushed it back by 10 many years. It's a small part of the 160 many year gap. So there's still a lot of work to do. And with this new search image, we have a better idea where to look for these early sponges and what kind of rocks are good for the preservation of this kind of fossil without the skeleton. And we know that they can be really big if they're preserved intact. So yeah, there's still a lot of work to do, and we just travel around the world to look rocks of right age and the right kind of rocks, and we apply not only the techniques to look at fossils. But also the technique to look at molecular traces left behind by ancient sponge animals.
Well, wonderful. And thank you so much for taking the time and sharing. I appreciate it, Shuhai.
Okay, thanks, Lucas.
Shuhai Shao is a geobiologist at Virginia Tech. His team's research is published in the journal Nature. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. This is the best of our knowledge. As the saying goes, all that glitters is gold. But that idea may have been a hard sell to some seafaring traders during the age of exploration between the 15th and 17th centuries. There was a common belief among European traders who voyaged along the West African coast that they were often short-changed. But the once common belief that European traders received gold that was purposefully mixed with other metals may have been debunked. And that brings us to our next guest. Tobias Skovanek is a geochemist who studies archaeology at the University of Bonn in Germany. In his team's research published in the journal Heritage Science, in his research published in the journal Heritage Science, Dr. Skovanek and his team analyzed gold found within a wrecked pirate ship off the coast of Cape Cod, to dispel a rumor that has persisted for centuries. The Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds spoke with him to learn more.
The name of the ship is the Ouida, or it would be more correct to call it Ouida, because it was named after a trading port in Nigeria, which is called Ouida. And it was built by a very influential British slave trader called Humphrey Morris. And he was also a member of the parliament and a very, very influential guy and a very rich guy as well. And he built that ship called the Ouida. And that ship was meant to trade for gold and slaves on the West African coast. But when it was going to the Caribbean, it was found by a pirate called Black Sam Bellamy. And this pirate was notorious. He was known to have taken 50 ships or the like. And he took the Ouida and make this very, very modern ship at the time, his flagship, and brought it up the coast all the way to Cape Cod in Massachusetts, where it was wrecked in a terrific storm at that time.
So how did you conduct your study into this, meaning the gold and finding out, you know, was this a misconception by the European traders, meaning they thought they were getting cheated out by the West African traders? But how did you conduct your study into this specifically?
When I was reading all the different historical books that talk about the trade and the gold trade and the way the gold was adulterated, that it was stretched with all the different materials, I thought about that these narratives were all brought up by the Europeans. There is no single written source made by Africans. So I thought these writings could not be neutral. And as I am a geochemist, I know how to analyze different kinds of materials, so also metals. And I thought, well, on this shipwreck, the Ouida, there were, I think, around 300 pieces of Akan gold. So gold from the Akan people of modern-day Ghana. And that was a unique opportunity for me to go there and asked the guys of the shipwreck center there to sample these gold objects and to look into them and to, in a way, to check if these historical sources are accurate.
I don't want to say I assume what the Europeans were using the gold for, but what were they using the gold for? Why was it so important to them?
The gold was not important because of its artistic value. They only wanted it to melt it down in Europe to make it like, own jewelry, or it acted like for doing money. In fact, people believe, or historians believe, that all of the gold from the high medieval time onwards is from West Africa. So the Portuguese traders, who first went to the coast of Ghana and built the fort of Elmina in the 15th century, and they had already heard about the gold, because prior to all of that Atlantic trade, there was this Trans-Saharan trade. So it was operated by Muslim traders, and they traded from North Africa all the way through the Sahara with the gold fields, which are in West Africa. And then when the Portuguese heard about that, they made their way to the West African coast. So the gold was, prior to the slaves, to the slave trade, the original, if you will, the original wish, what they wanted to trade with.
Out of curiosity, I mean, what would the West African traders get in return? Was it just money, or was there something that they were trading in exchange for?
The African traders asked for metals as well, but this would be copper and brass, especially brass, because brass, as an alloy of copper and zinc, has this golden hue. So it looks like gold, but it has completely different physical properties. And that is what the Africans did not have. Brass was never made in West Africa, and that is what they really wanted. And then there were some other trade materials like linen and cloth, and later also weapons like guns and gunpowder as well, then wine and other materials. Yeah.
So when it comes to your results of the study, I mean, what did you find with the gold specifically?
It was intriguing in a way, because when I started it, I did not believe that the gold should be that bad, that it should be that stretched or debased. But then we found pieces that had 25% of silver in it. And that was kind of unusual. So maybe there was something true about the trade and the European writers. But then again, if you compare the material, the gold of the Akan people, to the gold that is naturally occurring in the so-called Ashanti Gold Belt in Ghana, you see that the gold already is quite variable. And the gold there contains up to 25% silver. So this composition that would be then transferred from the ore to the object. So it is not surprising to find these high amounts of silver in the gold objects as well.
This is the best of our knowledge. If you're just joining us, Madeline Reynolds is speaking with Tobias Skovanek, a geochemist at the University of Bonn in Germany, about how his team analyzed gold found within a wrecked pirate ship to dispel a centuries-old belief among European traders. During the Age of Discovery, it was a common belief among European traders that West African traders intentionally shortchanged them by mixing gold with other cheaper metals.
The peoples that were forging this gold, there's a high likely possibility, you're saying, that it was just from the source, correct? The way that they were forging it. It wasn't like they were just mixing metals in, maybe, but from your results, that's possibly not likely as well.
Absolutely not, because we can see that it follows the same trend line, if you wish, in the diagrams. It has the same kind of, some have like 0% of silver, others have 25% of silver. The copper amount is also very comparable. So no, there is no indication that they did that. There is no indication that they added like brass filings, or some sources say they added coral dust. We didn't find anything like that. The thing is, why we think that is because there are other gold fields in West Africa, not only the Ashanti gold field. There are also gold fields in Senegal, Senegambia. And that is maybe where the Islamic trade was aimed for. And we don't know the composition of this gold, but there were some coin molds found, and they have been analyzed from the Islamic time. And they were all 100% gold. So you have to imagine it like the following. You are in Europe and you see that the gold that is coming from West Africa is quite poor. It has like 100% gold in Senegambia and Senegal. It is praised by Islamic sources. And then you go all the way as a Portuguese with your ship from Lisbon to the West African coast, and you get to trade with the Ashanti people of Ghana. And they present you their commodities of gold. And then you find, oh, there's already one quarter of it is actually silver. And you expect to get that gold that they traded before from Senegambia, which is maybe 100% pure gold. So they needed a scapegoat. They just didn't understand. So that is what we think what this is about.
Yeah. And I would love to go back to the pirates a little bit, because I find this fascinating. I mean, there is Black Sam. He's kind of infamous, right? You said he stole or like 50 ships. That's crazy. But I was curious about the history of pirates and trading. Like, we hear a lot of stories about them, you know, taking ships. And I wonder just how involved pirates were and just how much of a threat they were to, like, for example, the Triangle trade route. Was that very common for pirates to be on the waters trying to steal those big trade ships?
Yeah, because they knew that these ships, they collected commodities and riches from all over the Atlantic world. So like gold from West Africa, and then also different pigments, and also metals from the mining areas of South America, also gold from South America. So they knew that these ships were like like floating warehouses, if you wish. So, yeah.
And with this research as a whole, from a history perspective, it kind of changes it, right? We have this new perspective of actually The West African traders weren't purposely cheating out the European ones, right? And I feel like that's really interesting about history, is it's always changing and we get new perspectives.
That is why this research is so important, because it brings up a new kind of source of information that we didn't have before. Because now we have like these very advanced analytical techniques and can look at the objects themselves. You have to imagine that the whole Atlantic trade, the whole narrative of the early modern, is based on written sources alone. And what we do is a kind of bringing up a new source of information with looking at the objects, and then we have the possibility to change narratives.
And then finally, what do you plan on researching next, maybe into this or another topic entirely?
Oh, I have a lot of topics that I'm looking into right now. I mean, the Widder shipwreck is special, really, because it's not a single shipwreck. As I said earlier, the pirates were able to plunder more than 50 ships. So that is a unique wreck that has materials from all over the Atlantic. So there are other gold objects on the Widder, like from South America, maybe even from the Aztecs or the Maya culture or something like that. So they do not look like Arkan. But there are a lot of different stories that I am interested in, especially in the early modern era. You know, one example would be the story of Pocahontas. You know, the Disney movie Pocahontas. Is very, very interesting, because actually Pocahontas was sold for a single kettle. You know, kettles made of copper were very, very much sought after in the fur trade of North America when they traded with the Native Americans. And there is indication that these were also made in Germany. So it would be interesting to analyze these trade metals and compare it with other sites. And yeah, a lot of different things that I'm interested in.
That was Tobias Skovanek, a geochemist who studies archaeology at the University of Bonn in Germany. His research was originally published in the journal Heritage Science. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1856. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to our associate producer, Madeline Reynolds, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.